This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Don't bother making a lunch run to Starbucks today. Stores are closed for the afternoon for racial bias education. This follows the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks last month. Is racial bias something that can be trained out of us? That's what we're going to discuss now, and we'd like to hear from you. Have you undergone bias training? How did that go? Please give us a call. Area code 206-543-5869. 543-5869. My guest studies our biases. University of Washington psychology professor Tony Greenwald is one of the creators of the implicit association test. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, Bill.
Will you remind us briefly what the implicit association test is?
It is a test that can be taken online at the Project Implicit website. There are 14 tests. You can be totally anonymous, get feedback on your implicit biases, which may concern race, gender, several other things, sexual orientation. And it's a series of words and pictures that you classify, and you do them as rapidly as you can, and there are correct responses. You're not asked your opinion about anything, and the implicit association test indirectly measures your implicit biases by making use of the speed of your responses.
And I see this test cited all the time nationally. It's a very well-known test. This Starbucks training has been in the news for weeks, been in the news at my house. As you know, my wife works at Starbucks, involved in inclusion and diversity. I want people to know that. What is your understanding of what is happening at Starbucks stores this afternoon?
My understanding is that this is at each store, it's going to be a session just of the personnel who work at that store. And among themselves, they are going to be following through a protocol that's been worked out with a management consulting firm and some expert advice, trying to do what psychologists several decades ago might have called sensitivity training, trying to get people aware of problems and maybe motivate them to try to do something about it.
Why do you think that term sensitivity training has gone out of fashion?
That's a good question. I don't know if the technique is still used as it was once, so that may just mean that it's just not being used much anymore. But it was, you know, the words that accompanied it sometimes were sort of touchy-feely, and it was sort of trying to get people in a mode of being open to new ideas.
Based on what you know, how touchy-feely or productive does this Starbucks experiment sound, the closing of thousands of stores and this training?
Well, I don't think it's touchy-feely. I mean, that's my guess. I don't know in detail how this is going to be done. Not a lot is known about it yet. I think we will learn interesting things from people who have gone through it, and maybe you'll get a chance to ask some of them about this. I'd be curious to see how people react to it.
Again, we are asking you, the listener, to react to the idea of bias training. Have you gone through it yourself? And how did that go? Can you be changed? Have you been changed? Our phone number is 206-543-5869. Again, 543-5869. If you were running the training, Professor, what would you advise Starbucks?
Well, I wouldn't call it training because that implies you're going to solve some problems pretty quick.
Actually, I'm glad you said that. I think Starbucks calls it racial bias education, so they may not use the word training themselves. The media have been using it.
And I did notice that you used that on the lead.
Yes, I did.
This, and I think it is the proper term. I think both terms have been used. I think Starbucks initially started calling it training, but I think they got some feedback and maybe some pushback from people who, like me, were aware that this actually doesn't work as training. Perhaps it works as motivation.
Tell me about that. Why doesn't this work as training?
Well, many have been trying to develop means of eliminating or eradicating implicit biases by training, so maybe some form of conditioning. Lots of experiments have been done. It's found that you can actually push implicit biases slightly, but only briefly. These may be called elastic changes. If you measure them within 15 or 20 minutes after whatever intervention you've tried, you may observe something, but bring the same people back the next day, measure their implicit biases again, nothing. It's gone.
So what's the better answer?
The better answer is, instead of trying to change implicit biases, try to prevent implicit biases from impacting behavior. Try to prevent them from causing disparities.
What would be an example of that?
Well, one of the best known is a procedure called blinding, which is best known perhaps from its use in symphony orchestras.
Oh, yes.
Widely around the world. And this ended up producing evidence that there must have been a gender bias that was operating unintentionally in audition committees, because as soon as auditions started to be conducted behind a screen, so the audition committee couldn't tell whether it was a male or female performer, the rate of women being hired as instrumentalists in orchestras jumped noticeably.
Well, how would that apply at a Starbucks store?
Well, very good question, because these Starbucks store personnel are going to be seeing their clientele, so they are not going to be able to use it. And in this situation, the best strategy is to try to take judgment out of the process. I think in some of the episodes that were publicized, the store manager may have felt obliged to make a judgment on the scene as to whether there was a problem. And if the store's policies can be such that the manager doesn't have to make that judgment, but has a guided instruction as to how to deal with the situation, which Starbucks has indeed tried to do with their change of policy.
They announced that everybody gets to use the restroom. Yeah. The idea is to take judgment out of the question?
It remains to be seen, because this is something that may be a policy that sounds good on paper and may work, but in practice, how will it work? So I think we're probably waiting to find that out. There have been various stories, I think, indicating that it may have problems.
What would be an example of a problem?
A problem is, perhaps a store manager doesn't feel comfortable. And so it may not work well with individual store managers. They may not be able to actually act out the policy as satisfactorily as is desired.
Yes. What if a customer is yelling, for example, then and the manager still might have to make a decision? Is this about asking someone to leave or calling the police or saying, yes, you may use the bathroom? I mean, is that what you're suggesting, that you're still... We're still making subjective judgments here?
The change in policy partly deals with the problem, but as the example you just gave indicates, it may get out of control.
Yeah, and then who defines what yelling is or what's acceptable behavior?
Can you cover every contingency?
Yeah. We're talking with psychology professor Tony Greenwald from the University of Washington, one of the creators of the well-known implicit association test, and we're talking about today's racial bias education training that has shut down thousands of Starbucks stores across the country. And we're welcoming your story. Have you undergone bias training? Have you undergone that at work? What were you told about whether you had a choice in the matter? What were you told the goal was? How did it work for you? Give us a call at 206-543-5869, 543-5869. Howard Schultz, he's no longer CEO, but he's still the kind of runs the show at Starbucks. He was on CNN and talking about today's training, and he said that it includes people sharing their personal life experiences.
It's our personal life experience that has shaped whether or not we have bias. I grew up in a building with 100 families, with one elevator, 100 apartments of a very diverse group of people, white, Black, Italian, Jewish, Puerto Rican, Cuban, and we all had to get along. I did not see color as a kid.
I didn't see color. Is that a helpful story?
Well, it has to be interpreted through the lens of knowledge that we can't grow up in this country without seeing color. It's all around us. It's pervasive in the culture. the implicit biases that are very widely shared, probably Howard Schultz and I, and probably you, have some of these. I don't know if you've tried yourself on the implicit association test, but...
I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, you have something to learn. Please try it.
How about if I take that test and then we'll talk, okay?
Very good.
Okay, let's do that. Tell me more.
But, yeah, so I discovered this in myself when I took the first IAT implicit association test that I created, and I was very surprised. I mean, I was distressed to discover that I had a bias that I didn't know I had, and I was delighted to discover that I had found a technique to observe something in my head that I didn't know was there. I suspected it might be very useful in research, and it has proved that way.
What did you find in your head?
That I had what the IAT calls an automatic racial preference for white, which means that I respond much more rapidly to the pictures and the words when I am giving the same response to white faces and pleasant words or to black faces and unpleasant words than when the test does the switch. And so I'm obliged to try to give the same response to white faces and unpleasant words or black faces and pleasant words. I slow down. That slowdown can only mean that I've got something in my head that's interfering with my doing that.
So would you say that means you're racist?
No. The IAT does not measure racism. This is why we call the result automatic white preference. It does measure a preference. Racism is something that involves hostility. There's nothing about the IAT measure that gets at any bit of hostility.
Well, let's say more about that, because we certainly talk about whether someone is racist or not. I mean, it's a very high-stakes conversation. Nobody wants to be called racist.
Right. I don't want to be called racist, but I will say that I am implicitly biased. And I think that distinction is part of what can be, or understanding that distinction is part of what can be achieved through implicit bias education, to make that distinction so people do not feel they are being accused of being racist just because they've got the kind of result that I have, and I'm predicting you may have, and I'm guessing Howard Schultz may have in responding to this test.
Well, I'll ask you in a moment what you do about that, but we have a call from Lauren in Wallingford talking about this Starbucks bias training. And Lauren, you've undergone bias training yourself?
I have, because I'm an educator, have to treat all of my students equally.
What was the training, and how did it work for you?
Well, the training was several years ago. I've been involved with a lot of organizing for the rights, raises, and respect for early child educators, and we are a very diverse group. But we also work with a very, very diverse group of children and students. And I know this is a cliche, but it did change my life. It broadened my perspective.
How
it
so?
It made me learn about myself.
Will you give us an example of that? Yeah, give us an example, please, Lauren, of how it changed you.
Of how it changed my life?
Yes, yes.
I certainly, being a white person, I'm of Italian descent, but I'm looked at as being white, obviously, and I have a lot of privilege. It made me understand more about my privilege and my entitlement that I have in the world, and how I use that, and how I use that unconsciously and consciously.
And can you give us an example of how your life has changed because of that insight?
I'm very mindful and careful to see biases in the world, injustices. It just keeps me on my toes to watch for things that I perceive as unfair, especially white people, on how we deal with people of color and students of color. I know it's kind of a general, but it just keeps me more aware and mindful.
Any reaction, Professor?
Well, does it make you ever want to intervene when you observe something going on that you think might be bias being enacted by another person?
I have intervened.
Okay, well, this would be...
And I think it's my duty to do that.
that would be an interesting change. That is one of the things that can come from this awareness. Has it made you feel guilty? I mean, you're experiencing what some people might call white guilt.
You know how I feel about white guilt? White guilt is more of an attitude. And I think that's something that white people have to get over, the guilt. I think that we just have a duty to be in this world because we hold a lot of power. We're not followed around in cars. We're not pulled over by driving white. So, I've gotten rid of the guilt, but I do know that I have a lot of privilege, and I want to make sure that I'm not abusing that privilege, and I'm also doing things to right wrongs that we have in our society.
That's a good point, and I can't see any value of holding on to the guilt.
Lauren, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you, and thank you for having this program. It's really important.
Thanks. The phone number is 206-543-5869, and we're talking about Starbucks race education program that's happening today in stores across the country. I'm talking with University of Washington psychology professor Tony Greenwald about, I was asking you about racism, and you were saying there's a difference between racism and, you called it, automatic white preference, that racism involves hostility? I mean, does that let people off the hook who perpetuate a system of racial preference without being hostile or thinking of themselves as the bad, hostile person?
Well, I think that one can be a person who is an instrument of societal biases that are not personally endorsed. So we make the difference between what people say they believe, and many of the people who have this automatic white preference pattern on the IAT they regard themselves as egalitarian, and they honestly are when they are thinking about what they are doing. They will avoid doing anything that might be interpreted as otherwise. The problem, though, is that your thoughts may nevertheless be influenced by things in ways you don't recognize, and they may affect judgments that you make. So you really can't control implicit biases in real time just by being aware that you may have them.
Why, in my case, would I have an automatic white preference even though I don't want to? I mean, is it my parents' influence or my evolutionary biology or what?
No, it's actually the entertainment media and books and other literature that you have been exposed to since early childhood that has contained the elements of stereotypes and other biases. You've learned to associate African Americans more with criminality than whites just because they are portrayed that way in the media. And I have to add that this includes the news media.
Yes. Yeah. My people. And do you get into, in your implicit association test, whether something is fake news or not, or are you just dealing with, in other words, do you get into discussions of how biased people should or shouldn't be?
Well, that's up to people to judge for themselves. For myself, I want to be egalitarian. You asked about fake news. We are concerned as psychologists about people misrepresenting their beliefs when asked, are you unbiased? Many people who are actually biased, and this, I think, is a minority of the U.S. population, even though it's many people, will say, I have no biases. I like black and white equally. But in some private conversations with like-minded folks, they may express otherwise. This is what's called, in part, political correctness.
Right. We asked our listeners about this, and this is what Tammy had to say.
I worked with the school district many years ago, and they ran a program at the beginning of the school year for everybody called Courageous Conversations. And one of the exercises I will never forget is they separated everybody out by minorities and white people. And then they asked, when you go to the grocery store and the clerk is mean to you, what do you think? And the minorities thought that the people were prejudiced against them. And the white people thought the clerk was having a bad day. I never forgot that, and I really try to remember how people see things so differently. It was very powerful.
You're nodding your head, Professor.
These differences in perceptions are the kinds of things that are influenced by implicit biases.
So what are you hoping comes out of the fact that many Americans can't get a cup of coffee at Starbucks for 4 hours today?
Well, I think that Starbucks recognizes that they are not going to solve this problem today, and that what they are doing today is the start of something that is not yet well defined and will no doubt involve some trial and error and might take a few years to play out. But if they pursue this in the way they appear to be, they have the opportunity to show leadership in how to deal with this. I think it involves tracking their operations to see that they are actually fixing the problems they're concerned with.
How would they track that? You mean in their hiring practices, in their candidate pools, in barista interactions? How would Starbucks track this effectively?
I think that what they're concerned with is the interaction between store personnel and customers, and so I think that's what you need to look at. So one thing that may happen is when a black and white customer come into the same store, do they get the same treatment? Does it take the same amount of time for them to get service, both to have their order taken and to have it delivered? Do they stay in the store the same amount of time approximately? Do they feel equally comfortable there? I think that's what Starbucks wants them to feel. That's what they mean by talking about their establishments as the third place.
University of Washington psychology professor Tony Greenwald helped develop the implicit association test, which you can take. The address is implicit.harvard.edu. Professor Greenwald, thanks for coming in on Starbucks Racial Bias Education Day, and let's keep tracking, as you say, let's keep tracking this together.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate your interest in this.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, facial recognition at an airport near you. That's coming up on The Record. Stay tuned. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We were just talking with University of Washington psychology professor Tony Greenwald about teaching humans to overcome our biases. What about technology? Does artificial intelligence do any better at eliminating bias? And can we use it to spend less time waiting to get through airport security? The Department of Homeland Security just signed a contract with a UK-based firm called iProve to roll out facial recognition software in American airports and border checks. I talked about it with Europe news editor for Quartz, Liana Brinded. Liana, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this facial recognition software that's coming to American airports, which airports? Are we talking international arrivals only? How will our listeners experience this?
So they haven't given the full list of places yet because the contract's just been won. But what we can talk about is how this form of technology has actually been used across like most European countries and other countries across the world. You usually have a chip in your passport that enables you to go into this queue where you use biometrics. So for example, if I went to France tomorrow, which is what I'm going to do, you can go into one where you use scan your passport, scan your face, and you go through some doors. Whereas if you don't have the chip in your passport, or if you come from an international country, one that isn't part of the EU, then you still have to go to a regular person at a desk.
Liana, what's your experience like dealing with human beings when you come to the United States? You fly here a lot. Do you have a customs horror story?
Well, I've had many bad border experiences, mainly because I don't seem to fit in a box of what a human border control person ever considers what they think as a British citizen. I look a bit different, I suppose. I am ethnically mixed. I'm Chinese, English, and Irish. I also have bright red hair as well, so that doesn't really help things, I suppose. Mm. But when I went to Newark Airport, this is probably one of the most stressful experiences that I've had, is that when it came up to border control, I was grilled about where I was from, and I said I was British. I was asked, where are you really from? Which, of course, you can tell by the tone, that means, you know, what ethnic mix are you? This led to a long question over my identity and also how they think this stacks up to the information that they have about my passport, about my picture, and whether they think I fit the box of what they think a British person is. So it's stuck with me to this day, and it can be exceptionally stressful. But yeah, that was probably one of my worst experiences I've had.
Yes, you're telling a story of bias at the hands of a human. Are you suggesting that technology could help that by removing the prejudices of the person at the customs desk?
So there's two thoughts on this. I do think that the technology, if it's programmed correctly and if it is being tested rigorously to show that it solved some biases and has a very high accuracy rate, then I do think that will not only make things more efficient, but it can make things more secure and safer. However, there's the other prong to it where some of the technology that has been trialed and put through rigorous testing has shown that even with technology, the darker your skin is, the more mistakes those systems make, showing that there is a significant bias when it comes to people of color.
Why does that happen?
So when it comes to AI and program technology, you've got to think of who created it. And behind the creation of this technology, it is predominantly programmed and made by white men. Those biases can seep into how something's programmed, how a program identifies faces, that kind of thing. There's been various studies across Microsoft and IBM where it's even shown that after these rigorous tests, it's been 95% accurate when it's come to recognizing lighter skinned women, but then it's been at least 10 times more frequently mistaken when it's examining photos of dark skinned women.
You say the software tends to be designed by white men, so how does that racial gender bias you're talking about, how does that creep in?
The people who are programming it, when you think about being architects of this system, there's been, again, lots of, you know, studies, even before this kind of technology is rolled out, that shows that people are more likely to be more accurate in identifying people within their own race. So you got to then think, if those people are then programming and putting together the machinery in order to deal with the nuances of different races, then that kind of bias will naturally creep into that. They may not even, that's the point, they may not even know that they're being biased in terms of that programming. But again, this is something that the tech industry seems to be very much honing in on to make better.
I'm talking with Liana Brinded, Europe news editor at Quartz, and she's written about facial recognition software at the border. On balance, Liana, how are you feeling, that technology like this is more positive or more disturbing?
So it really depends, like putting it into the context of the environment that it's implemented in. We already, I do think, you know, we have given up our privacy forever. I mean, we live in a digital age. You know, even if you go to a, you know, store down the road and got yourself a rewards card for even somewhere like Costco, they will have so much more information on you than maybe even your colleague does. It's very easy now to track exactly where you are, what you like, what you do, what your age is, all that form of things. We've got CCTV everywhere. So in that sense, of course, you know, we've progressed into an age where it's potentially impossible to be private. At the same time, you got to think that there is a very real heightened risk in terms of crime and national security. So countries and governments and companies, of course, need to move with the times and make sure they're safeguarding their citizens. Where we need to be a bit more worried is if this kind of technology isn't just in airports, but if, let's say, stations and restaurants and when you walk down the street, that's when you have to get a bit more worried.
What is the worst thing that could happen at the airport if bias is not corrected in this software?
The problem is that if any kind of facial recognition software isn't, you know, at least near as possible to 100% accurate, it can actually, you know, affect the person. It can be a very traumatizing experience as well, not just on day-to-day, the fact that, you know, you're not recognized because of, you're not being accurately recognized because of your skin color, but also it can be traumatizing because of the amount of bureaucracy and paperwork and having to tell people who you are is who you are. So it's not just about making sure, you know, the country's safe. It's also about making sure that you are giving some kinds of sensitivity to these people that are coming through, because at the end of the day, they're people and they're not just, you know, robots that you need to identify. They will take these experiences back with them for the rest of their lives.
Liana Brinded, Europe News Editor for Quartz, guarded optimist about technology at the borders. Liana, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And coming up on KUOW's The Record, we're going to get into the controversial selection process for Seattle's new chief of police and a couple of other stories that caught our attention over the weekend, including the oddly successful Seattle Mariners. Stay tuned. There is a rally at Seattle City Hall this afternoon. The organizers are calling on city officials to redo the selection process for Seattle Police Chief. Three finalists for Chief of Police were just announced on Friday. KUOW reporter Amy Radel is here to discuss. Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
First of all, who are the finalists?
So the three finalists are Eli Reyes. He's the Assistant Chief of the Austin Police Department. Cameron McLay, the former Chief of Police for the City of Pittsburgh. And Eddie Frizzell, he's an inspector at the Minneapolis Police Department.
And why this call, Amy, for a do-over in the selection process?
There's kind of two issues, and they're related but distinct. The first one is our interim chief, Carmen Best, is not on that list. She's a 26-year veteran of the Seattle Police Department. She seems to have had support from very different constituencies, the union to the reformers. The Seattle Police Officers Guild put out a statement that they are upset that she's not among the finalists. But it's not just loyalty to the hometown candidate who happens to be an African-American woman at a time when there's a lot of concern about racial disparities in policing. There's no women finalists. In those three. The other aspect of this outcry is about how the selection process worked. We had a big committee, the selection committee. They represented all kinds of people concerned with policing coming from diverse backgrounds. We had community input. But then at the end, they put it, there was kind of this little tagged on process that was different. It hasn't happened this way in previous years.
And what are the questions or concerns about that process?
It was kind of a middleman that was inserted this time around. So in the past, this hiring, the selection committee simply submitted three names to the mayor, and the mayor made the final choice. This time, they submitted five names to this special group of people that are mostly people from Mayor Durkan's administration, and then also Ron Sims, the former King County executive, were in this group. And this group says they took those five names, they gave some kind of an exam to the five candidates, and from there, they picked the top three.
And what do we know about these results?
It's all very recent. They were just announced last Friday. Mayor Durkan wasn't there. It was people from the selection committee, and then this group of assessors were present. Mike McGinn tweeted, he called it a Friday news dump before a holiday weekend. That timing always kind of attracts some notice. Of course, the main questions from the media and the community was just why Carmen Best wasn't a finalist. She's the name that, you know, most people were the most familiar with out of these candidates. And Tim Burgess tried to answer that question.
He was a city councilor.
Yes, he's he was the co-chair of one of the co-chairs of this big selection committee. He said they had a lot of debate, but Chief Best was not a finalist because in the end they wanted to bring SPD's next chief from outside the department. In the wake of the 2012 consent decree, he said the police department is still working on foundational cultural reform, is how he described it. People I've spoken to have said if that were the case, they could have actually just made the process smoother for Chief Best. Apparently, they told her very late in the process that she was not one of the finalists, and they, you know, just could have maybe given her kind of a heads up. You know, we're really looking for someone from outside. So
given the objection that some people have, Amy, what's going to happen next?
So we have protests at City Hall today. People are going to the city council meeting this afternoon to say they want to re-examine it. They're upset with what they feel was a lack of transparency. And but if those protests don't change anything, the process would be for the mayor to interview these three finalists, make her pick by late June or early July, and she will forward that to the Seattle City Council for the confirmation process. Lorena Gonzalez is on the council, but she has also been part of the selection committee. She's been accompanying this. I don't think we know yet why the process had these different kinds of twists and turns compared to other years, but apparently nothing in Seattle can be simple right now.
That's KUOW reporter Amy Radel filling you in on the selection process for the next police chief of Seattle. Amy, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. That search for the new police chief in Seattle dominated headlines going into the holiday weekend. Now we're joined by a panel of guests to talk about that and some other stories that caught our attention over the weekend. Kevin Schofield is a writer and editor at Seattle City Council Insight, which is a blog devoted to news and analysis of the city council. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Britt Thorson is managing editor of Seattle Refined, an online lifestyle magazine. Welcome, Britt.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Kevin. KOW's Amy Radel just gave us the latest on this search for a new police chief, down to three finalists, and you've been following this very closely yourself. What do you think of Carmen Best's, the interim police chief's, absence from the top three?
Well, I think it's certainly very curious, and it was a big surprise last week to all the reporters who were covering this story, as well as to all the outside community members. And it seems like it was a surprise to at least some of the members on this 25-person search committee that had submitted the five names. When you read this memo, this really interesting memo that the four search committee co-chairs sent on their own to Mayor Durkan, it really goes a little bit more detail beyond Burgess's statement that this was about a culture change. And it lays out several very pointed criticisms of the leadership and supervisors in the Seattle Police Department. And while it doesn't explicitly say we need an outsider, it does say, it does imply very heavily that someone in Carmen Best's position, who was deputy chief for many years and then interim chief, is perhaps too deeply embedded inside that leadership and supervisory structure that really needs further reform to be able to make the kinds of reforms that need to happen.
Did these co-chairs call out Carmen Best by name in any of those observations, or were they just observing generally that, well, we've had problems for years? She's been here for years. What did they say?
Well, it's interesting. Right up front, they say, you know, with this memo, we're delivering the five names from the search committee. We think they're all qualified to be chief.
Okay.
And then after that, it didn't go on to name her at all explicitly.
Okay. Britt, your reaction to this story, you've been reading in on this as well.
I have. I think it's fishy. I feel like we don't know something that they know. Why were there so many differences this time around? Why is the one insider, I believe of the five, Carmen was the only insider that was actually in the Seattle Police Department. She's done a great job. She has support from all sides. And yet the party line that they're going with is that they wanted an outsider. Well, if they wanted an outsider to create, leadership reformation, doesn't Best have support from police reformers here too? I just don't understand, I guess, why I feel like we're missing something, and I don't want to go immediately to, you know, she's an African-American woman. What happened there? Was that, you know, subconsciously part of this decision? But I feel like unless we get some other sort of explanation, we get more documents showing what the process was, I feel like that is the way the only way to take what's happened.
So that's what would give you confidence, is more explanation, more transparency in the process?
I want to know why this special committee after the committee that's made up of mainly the mayor's staff, I need, and I think, I'm not speaking for myself, I feel like the city deserves, especially with something like the police department that has had a lot of eyes on us for a long time, I think we deserve more information to see where they led. And again, I can kind of understand what they were thinking when they said, let's bring an outsider in. Sometimes, you know, fresh eyes on a situation, that whole thing. I get that, but that doesn't really seem like it is, that doesn't hold enough weight with what happened. Best has, you know, proponents on both sides, you know, police reform activists and people within the police, you know, her colleagues within the police department. So I don't understand why she would be a big red flag. Again, unless we don't know something big that they know, there's always that chance.
Kevin, any final thoughts on this?
I think this is really the second big test of Mayor Durkan, after just coming right on the heels of the head tax debate, where she had to expend a lot of political capital with certain communities in Seattle. And now she has to go back to them and say, you know, for some of those communities, you're not going to get the police chief that you wanted out of this. That's going to be tough for her to sell.
We'll watch. That's the latest on the selection process and the reaction when it comes to the Seattle police chief. Another story that's getting a lot of attention, the cast of the TV show Arrested Development gave a group interview to the New York Times, and they discussed the actor Jeffrey Tambor having yelled at his colleague, the actor Jessica Walter, who plays Tambor's wife on Arrested Development. We have a little audio from that interview, which starts with the actor Jason Bateman on the cast defending Jeffrey Tambor's behavior.
Certain people have certain processes.
That doesn't mean it's acceptable. And no, the point is that things are changing and people need to respect each other differently.
I just realized in this conversation that I have to let go of being angry at him. He never crossed the line on our show with any, you know, sexual whatever. Verbally, yes, he harassed me, but he did apologize. I have to let it go, and I have to give you a chance to you know, for us to be friends again.
Absolutely.
But it's hard because, honestly, Jason says this happens all the time. In like almost 60 years of working, I've never had anybody yell at me like that on a set.
So that was actors Jason Bateman, Alia Shawkat, and Jessica Walter talking to the New York Times about an outburst Jeffrey Tambor had on set toward Walter. And Bateman got a lot of blowback and later apologized for his part in that New York Times interview, admitting that he was mansplaining to Jessica Walter. Britt, you have said that we need to be careful here about where we draw the line on what's acceptable in a workplace.
I think that it's really important to go into this conversation also with the knowledge that Tambor, you know, was essentially fired from Transparent, his other show, for under allegations of sexual misconduct for, I think, an assistant and a fellow actress. So,
and he claims that it was that he can be mean and yes, has been, and but not a harasser.
And that's his big defense in everything he's come out, is that he can be grumpy and mean and he can get angry, but he's never crossed the line sexually. I think that going into this kind of verbal blow up with Jessica Walters, I think with that in the back of our heads, at least for me, it makes me feel more inclined to believe the sexual assault claims, to be honest, because harassment is harassment. I think it spans a lot. You know, it can be one thing or another, and it can be various levels of, you know, depending on who's giving it and who's taking it. Verbal harassment is still harassment. And it doesn't sound like he just got kind of mad at her, you know, and just kind of like said, hey, don't do that. It sounds like this was a blow. And again, we won't know because no one knows what the blow up was. This sounds like it affected her. And in her 60 years of working, she'd never been spoken to like this before. That to me doesn't seem like it was just a little like, oh, all coworkers get mad at each other sometimes. It seems like it was something where she has said that she was scared of him.
Do you think we can draw a bright legal or cultural line when it comes to verbal non-sexual harassment in the workplace?
I don't. I think it's too, and again, I think this is why people are so, you know, taken with the Me Too movement, is that this is not black and white. It's gray. And the grayness depends on the history you have with that person, the way they've treated you in other aspects, your personal and professional relationship with them, your hierarchy. Are you below or are you above that person? Or are you on the same level? And if, you know, that was why I was disappointed. I really like Jason Bateman as an actor. I was really disappointed to see him so fervently defend Tambor in this interview. You know, if Walter said that she was harassed, it doesn't matter what Tambor or Bateman think that, you know, oh, it wasn't that bad. The person who's being harassed gets to make the decision about their own feelings. Like, those are their feelings.
Kevin, do you agree the person who's being harassed gets to make the decision about what's harassment?
I think Britt is absolutely on point, absolutely right about this. Verbal harassment is a form of harassment. It's a form of physical intimidation. And it's rewarded in far too many workplaces by reinforcing the power dynamics in place. It's absolutely unacceptable, and we let it go far too many times.
By the way, Kevin, you were general manager of Microsoft Research. Did Bill Gates yell at you?
Many times. Many times.
And what did that feel workplace harassment?
I'll come back to the point I made a moment.
Because you're the one who gets, you just said that, both said you're the one who gets to decide that.
It was certainly a form of physical intimidation that reinforced the power dynamics and of him being the boss and getting his way and wanting people around him to behave in certain ways.
Are you comfortable accusing Bill Gates of workplace harassment? Because isn't that what we're saying? These definitions are coalescing.
I would want to go think about that rather than sort of the spur of the moment make a claim like that.
Yeah.
I would want to go think about that. Yeah. Absolutely. It's not a clear yes or no.
But I do think, again, what you just did there was trying to draw a black and white line. Like, if you're saying this, then this has to always happen. I think that's what the whole point of this is that you can't draw that line. You can't just say, oh, since I feel bad, someone yelled at me, that immediately is harassment. You have to take into account each individual person. And, did you just not feel good because your boss told you to, you got to meet a deadline next time and kind of raised your voice? Or was it something where maybe you had had traumatic experience with people yelling at you in the past? Maybe you had a bad relationship. You grew up with an abusive parent or something. And this triggered, every single human being has lived a different life. So someone yelling at you can mean different things. You can brush it off your shoulder because, it doesn't affect you that much. You're not that, you don't care about your job that much. It's just another boss yelling at you. Or it can be a triggering moment of kind of, I feel unsafe in this workplace. I feel beat up upon. I feel, maligned. And again, I do not think, and it's frustrating too, because I want every HR, department in every building everywhere to have a bullet point in there that says X, Y, and Z, some magical wording that we can actually have to say black, white, yes, no, here's what's appropriate, here's what's not. That's not going to happen. It's too convoluted for that. And I think that's the reason why we are going to keep having these issues come forward with, celebrities, and probably a lot of the issues coming forward with non-celebrity workplaces, around cities across the world.
Let's end on some happy yelling. The Seattle Mariners are 33-20, one game behind the defending World Series champs, Houston Astros. Kevin, you went to spring training. I understand you do every year. Did you see this coming?
I did not see this coming at all. And, when you look, now that we're 2 months into the season, you look at kind of how they're doing. This is not a complicated game, right? If you score more runs than the other team, you win. And when you look at, just accumulatively the number of runs that the Mariners have scored over their games in the first 2 months, it's really not that much than they've let other teams score. So they should.
Right. They're winning a lot of close games.
They should be positive, but they should not be winning this many games. Now, part of it is that last month they had a pretty easy schedule. They played some pretty kind of mediocre to poor teams.
Rats. Britt, you're a lifelong Seattleite, fan of the 90s Mariners. What do you think of this late spring optimism?
I get nervous every single year when we get excited about the Mariners, because I feel like history has proven that we get really excited and we get our hopes up and then we usually come crashing down. And I feel like this, and again, this is me looking at a glass half empty.
Look at Kevin as you tell him. You're being very protective of Kevin's feelings right now.
I'm trying to be very protective of your feelings. I have so many friends who get so pumped up and then it's like heartbreak over and over again. And it's just like, why do you do this to yourselves? Again, now let's fast forward a couple months and let's say they continue this, and I'm totally going to jump on the bandwagon and pretend like this interview never happened. But I kind of have a feeling that, like other years, we're going to start having to actually play real baseball and not leaving it up to these coin flip games.
Well, I think, it's kind of a famous truism for baseball players when they get interviewed by the press to say, well, we just go out there and we play one game at a time. I think we just watch one game at a time right now. Right?
Uh-huh.
Enjoy every win.
Right.
Eat some hot dogs, drink some beer, and just have fun with it.
I'm just nervous for your heart. I'm nervous for your heart.
Right. Forget the fact that I just told you at the beginning that the Mariners are 33-20. Forget that. Fourth best record in the American League West. Take it one game at a time. Probably be healthier for your constitution.
Well, yeah, we'll see a month from now after they played Boston, New York, and Houston how they're doing.
Let's. Kevin Schofield, writer, editor, Seattle City Council Insight, a blog devoted to news and analysis of the city council. Britt Thorson is managing editor of the online lifestyle magazine, Seattle Refined. It's a treat, that site.
Yeah.
And thanks for reviewing the weekend with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. That's our show, produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano, our social media producer, Bree Ripley. Come back tomorrow. My guest is Merriam-Webster lexicographer Peter Sokolowski. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.